Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Transatlanticist at the Amerikazentrum in Hamburg. As always, I am your host, Andrew Sola. Let's start this episode with a poem, with thanks to Shakespeare. Double, double, toil and trouble, fire burn and cauldron bubble, migrants on a sinking boat, solutions now seem remote. Salvini, Orban, Madame Le Pen, goodbye Europe, said Big Ben. Corruption, fraud and fake news, recession, debt and food bank queues. Europe on a right-wing trend. For Angie Merkel, is this the end? Like a hell broth boil and bubble. For the European Union, I smell trouble. Once again, the toxic brew of populism and xenophobia, Euroscepticism and resurgent nationalism has reached a boiling point. And the most important ingredient in this bubbling political cauldron is immigration. Last week, the new Italian Interior Minister, Matteo Salvini, refused to allow the Aquarius, a rescue boat full of 629 immigrants, to dock in Italian ports. The boat was stranded at sea until the Spanish government intervened and allowed the migrants to land in Valencia. Salvini's actions have prompted now an EU-wide crisis with both humanitarian and political ramifications. So how will the EU deal with the immigration crisis? Will the EU create a fortress Europe? Or will EU countries share the burden of migrants and refugees? Are there perhaps other solutions? And what are the political consequences for Europe? Will Chancellor Merkel's coalition government survive? Are we witnessing the end of her political career? Will Italy drive further segmentation and division in the EU? Here to answer these questions is our esteemed expert in European politics and international economics at the EU capital in Brussels, Dr. Günter Donner. Welcome once again, Dr. Donner.
Hello.
So today we'll discuss the complexities of the migration crisis, but also on our agenda today are two fairly serious European economic issues that have mostly flown under the radar because of the migration crisis. First, the U.S. Treasury accused Latvia's third-largest bank of money laundering, while at the same time the head of the Latvian Central Bank was accused of both bribery and corruption. Secondly, the EU reached an agreement with Greece to end its bailout. But first, we need to discuss the European migration crisis, which really started in Italy. So let's recap the political situation there. Italy had elections in March, but there was no clear winner. Therefore, the leading party, the populist Five Star Movement, was forced to find a coalition partner. And they found a willing, albeit aggressive, partner in Matteo Salvini, the leader of the right-wing nationalist Lega Nord, the Northern League. Salvini was given the position of interior minister, and practically his first decision was to close Italian ports to ships with migrants. And suddenly, the rest of Europe had to react. One of the first political victims was Chancellor Merkel. Dr. Donner, can you help us understand how Salvini's actions have affected Chancellor Merkel, German politics, and European politics as a whole?
Well, as a matter of fact, Salvini is just trying to put into practice ideas, conceptions, and demands. Everyone familiar with his electoral campaign would have anticipated. What is so difficult to understand for outsiders is that Salvini arrived at where he is now in a coalition of the extreme right based on his own party, no longer the Lega Nord. He renamed himself in order to apply to public protest demands in southern Italy, where the migration crisis produced or shows most clearly because that is where the refugees from Africa tend to come ashore. Then his two partners, quite unknown, well, the one is Berlusconi's Forza Italia. He managed to hold himself at bay from the present government, although he had previously agreed to Salvini entering this government, this new coalition with the Five Star Movement. The third party in all this is rarely discussed. It's the openly fascist Fratelli d'Italia, which is today's name given to what had been known for decades as the Movimento Sociale. That was the post-Mussolini revival party. So amidst all this, there is plenty of right-wing ideology around. On the other hand, you find ideological concepts and solutions, in inverted commas, also among the Five Star Movement. The Five Star Movement is very difficult to place. Its ideology is based on anti-establishment convictions, hatred, bordering on vulgarisms.
And no love for the EU.
And of course, they are bitterly opposed to the EU, which is probably even more so than to Salvini, Merkel and Germany, with all their economic success and strength, represent what is the EU? The EU is a disguise for German domination, which of course is quite far from being the truth. So that's why these two camps now agree. Probably 5 years ago, they would have been at each other's throats. That has changed. The Five Star Movement, being populist, has realized that being populist now can only be on the right wing. There is no left wing, no credible left wing populism anymore. There's a bit of international protest, whatever, G20-like things. But even there, the mainstream majorities tend to move towards the right. That for various reasons. The migration issue now will, of course, has affected Italy. Not because so many migrants have actually claimed asylum there. To be frank, most of those stepping on the Italian shores plan to travel further to other countries. In fact, Italy holds a certain record in terms of numbers of refugees, especially the boat people type. You have to keep apart the boat people type coming from Northern Africa, mostly black Africans. And you have to keep them apart from the former Balkan route, where mostly people of Arabic or Afghan or Pakistani origin come all the way up to Europe, fleeing from war zones and the like. So Italy was mostly hit hard by an enormous influx of boat people coming from Northern Africa. The country receives money for refugees from the European Union. There's quite little you see in terms of integration. The Italian welfare state is not very generous. The Italian practice of privatizing much of the integration efforts has led to corruption and mismanagement.
What type of corruption are we talking
about? Well, we talk about a rundown hotel abandoned for years, now transformed into a camp for training, of integrational training to refugees, and all this is run by people who know where and how to pull the strings.
So the EU pays money to house and integrate parts of migrants, this, but yeah, the money is redirected into the pockets of
business
people.
Indeed, at least parts of this, and this can be clearly proven, and that has been reported on in the press. The problem for Italy, of course, is that municipal infrastructure is rather weak and the municipalities cannot cope with the influx of refugees. There is still, it has improved, but there is still a considerable deficit in administrative precision in handling with the individual cases, keeping track of them. In fact, many just disappear. And you can see this, they wish to leave Italy, to either go to France, you now have a quite well-sealed border between France and Italy, with daily inspections of trains and roads and whatever, in order to stop immigrants leaving Italy and moving into France, where the social security system is considerably higher and more generous. Italy is far from being productive. Italy is heavily over-indebted. And there is a general understanding that life is not fair for probably the majority of Italians. If you're not well-connected family-wise, you have your problems. This public disappointment is now channeled and fueled into these anti-migration thing.
Indeed, Salvini's slogan is now Italy for Italians, which is quite similar to Trump's Make America Great Again slogan, and it calls to mind any number of right-wing movements in Europe. Indeed, nearly every right-wing populist is saying the same thing. Orban says Hungary for Hungarians, Le Pen says France for the French. Should we just accept the fact that the vast majority of Europeans believe that Europe should be for Europeans?
Well, this question is quite manifold. Let us start with the theoretical. Each and every welfare system has a limit beyond which it won't function anymore. We have to bear in mind that the level of systems of social aid or of welfare state systems within the EU is extremely heterogeneous. So there are countries with an extremely generous portfolio like Denmark, Sweden, Germany, or Luxembourg, or the Netherlands, and others where you get next to nothing. That is Poland and Hungary, Romania and Bulgaria, and even Italy is very poor. So it's very easy to understand that where there is already poverty galore amidst the genuine population on spot, any massive influx of recipients of social aid will cause the collapse of the system, the complete collapse and the downfall of the social system. That is one thing. The other is right-wing governments tend to be monothematic in character. So it's one subject they deal with, which normally is we and they. And the we and they thing works perfectly well and makes you forget that probably the we is far less clearly defined in Italy than it is defined in Denmark.
Indeed, we saw this with Salvini in the 90s, constructing a we and they, we, the northern Italians,
indeed,
against them, the southern Italians. And he realized that wasn't productive politically anymore, so he apologized to the southern Italians for excluding them from Italy 15 years ago, and he now has chosen another group to exclude, which was politically wise. Whether or not it shows any integrity in the man is yet to be seen.
Well, it's clear he's a shrewd politician, a demagogue, and he knows the game he's playing quite well. And he knows that far beyond the group of his prime supporters, he will find positive feedback when criticizing the European Union, Germany, Mrs. Merkel in particular, and accusing them of instrumentalizing Italy for their purposes or exploiting Italians or depriving Italians of their just position within Europe as a founding member state. Even the so-called intellectual left in Italy, fiercely against Europe because Europe is pro-market and market is the devil's realm. I know left-wing Italian so-called intellectuals who do not like Salvini, but who approve of his politics now, which is rather contradictory. It's pragmatism at quite a low level. And I think the opposition has very little to offer in order to counterweigh his things, because they haven't done anything. And just they wished to please Brussels. And they were accused of being Brussels puppets. And now he's there and he has to show that he's not a puppet of neither Brussels nor Frau Merkel. And that's what he's about to do.
Indeed. And I think he probably knew that when he denied entry of the Aquarius boat to Italian ports, he knew that eventually the fallout of that decision would touch Merkel's coalition, because she is in a coalition with, let's say, SU, the sister party of Germany's party. It's the Bavarian wing of the party. And there has been some trouble with that coalition in the last week, mostly instigated by Salvini's decision to prevent the refugee boat from landing. So can you talk a little bit about the relationship between Merkel and Horst Seehofer?
I think it has less to do with the Italian readiness to deprive a rescue ship from entering an Italian harbor.
This made it international news, though. It forced them to engage.
The German trouble is rather homemade. It's a Leberwurst type of trouble. The thing is, there are elections in the state of Bavaria, state elections looming on the horizon for mid-October. The CSU there, it's as a staunchly Catholic, bourgeois, conservative, pro-American, pro-NATO, and also pro-European party, has been shattered by the enormous success the new German right, the AfD, is about to see. According to polls now, the CSU, once under Herr Strauss, around the 60% of the vote, so an incredible Orban-style majority, is now down to 40, let's say 41%. The SPD, on the other hand, in Bavaria, is down to 12, which really raises the question, is this still a party with a mass following, or is it a splinter party, as we call it in German? So the CSU is absolutely motivated by their panic to lose what they've enjoyed in Bavaria for decades on end. Their rule there has been there for ever since the post-war Germany existed, with few exceptions, early 50s. They were the rulers of Bavaria. And they wish to continue as such. And according to the polls, they will have to look for a coalition partner. The liberals will be probably not represented. They won't master the threshold. It's difficult for them to figure out who to form a coalition with. And the coalition as such for them is a horror, because they wish to rule by themselves. So that is where...
And again, we're still talking about within the state of Bavaria.
Yeah, they have their
own... So take this into the national scene. These are traditional allies of Merkel's government, going back...
For decades. Yeah.
And now the chairman of the Bavarian party put a lot of pressure on Merkel to address the migrant policies that Germany has. And we've seen Merkel wavering. Her complete authority is wavering.
Definitely.
So can you talk a little bit more about that, please?
Yes, Merkel's authority, it's more than wavering. Seehofer, as a Bavarian, threatens unilateral action. That means Bavarian border controls. Constitutionally, this wouldn't last. From Merkel, as the Chancellor, has the right to fire him within an hour. This is just a shallow threat. But this would probably put an end to their common role they play within the federal parliament. All this is more noise than action. The problem is Seehofer needs to present his party as the strong party doing something, and doing something different to what's been told to the German public ever since the influx of 2015. So from Merkel at the onset, I had the phrases of "we need to wait for a European solution." She didn't define it then, as she didn't define it in October 9, 2015. There was indeed a European attempt of a solution in October 2015, when 150,000 out of millions of refugees should be quota to individual member states. This never materialized beyond the level of a few thousand people, for a very simple reason. Some states refused it. Others questioned the whole the whole gist of the affair, because we have totally different systems of social aid. And the refugee being sent on a quota ticket to Romania instead of to Copenhagen will bitterly regret it. The difference is 750 euros pocket money in Copenhagen. That has already been reduced from 1,500. And Romania, he will probably get 20.
Okay, so that was the solution planned in 2015, yes. which never came about. And I do want to discuss solutions now. Next week, I believe, the 10 presidents or leaders of European countries are meeting in Brussels to try to come up with a European solution to the migration problem. Mm-hmm. So what are the different solutions, and are any of them actually feasible either practically and also politically? Because we can solve a problem, but if politically no one's willing to sign up for it, then it's also not a solution.
Well, we have to bear in mind that already a few European standards seem to have been given up by Frau Merkel as well. The European state of affairs is the Dublin Convention, where the refugee has to stay within the first EU member state where he or she sets foot. This is European legislation. It's long since been abandoned for several reasons, because we all know that it's a very unbalanced distribution of refugees. Right, one thing. The second is the quota thing is out of discussion, no longer really discussed. It's probably dead. The third now is what Mrs. Merkel calls the European solution is more or less based on bilateral agreements. Of course, Germany and Austria can arrive at a whatever temporary solution for their common border. So what would Germany do with refugees leaving Austria and wishing to enter Germany? Will they send them back? Will they have to sit in no man's land? Or will the Austrians take them back? Or will the Austrians stop them from ever reaching the border area? This is all part of, I would call this, a bilateral agreement. What is with a refugee who still has a documentation that he entered the EU in Italy, and now he turns up in Copenhagen? Who will take him or her back? This is uncertain. The Austrian Chancellor and the Danish Prime Minister have added very strong criticisms of the present state of affairs, and wish to stop refugees on North African soil. The Dane has also come up with the idea of making a depot or whatever, a stopover place in Albania, a safe
indeed
haven.
And it was just reported that no country was willing to host this. So
how
that's
could
again
this,
how could
this have been expected?
Yeah.
The idea of producing now a European solution, be this safe havens on North African soil or elsewhere, within a week, and that has not been possible to conceive within the last 3 years, is far from being realistic. It's more or less it's talk. And so what might be agreed upon is a declaration, but as we all know, there will be no pre-formulated, pre-summit joint declaration, because the Italian Prime Minister Conte preferred not to. I think the basic issue is we are already past a European solution. I do not believe in a tangible European solution. I believe, indeed, in a few approaches of European member states, EU member states, with bilateral or multilateral agreements or what to do with the refugees. But one thing is
important. So internally, you're talking about internally bilateral agreements. So
you can
between Italy and Austria, or between
of course
between
you can,
Italy
but you
and
could,
France.
You could sign, you
but
could,
nothing. The EU has lost all of its
the EU has lost all
to,
of its momentum
to solve this,
because Brussels is more or less hosting a discussion. Brussels has very little to offer. Rumors have it that Herr Juncker now favors such safe havens on African soil, but that still is light years away from reality.
They need to essentially bribe an North African state with enough money for them to accept.
Yes, and they would have to see to it that the fate of the poor refugees there will be under EU humanitarian control. Because the reality of what people expect in Libya, at the mercy of the Libyan anarchy warlords, is probably nothing the EU could ever associate with without losing its reputation. But this will take months, if not years, to perfect. Maybe you can do it. It's probably a question of money. It's a question of know-how you put into it. But one thing is clear, and I think this should be understood. Solving the African socio-economic catastrophe by just encouraging or allowing people to move over to Denmark, Sweden, Germany, wherever, is no solution. It can't work. The problem to me is, what can the EU produce as to be part of the solution and not part of the problem? And I'm not too sure that for the time being, everybody has laid his or her deck of cards on the table. This certainly is true about Herr Macron. Herr Macron has tightly sealed the border to Italy for one purpose alone, to keep refugees at bay and away from France.
Right, and I think I haven't seen this in the news. Is no one really discussing so-called Fortress Europe again? Just a sealing of the external borders, which of course is very difficult because the borders are huge. It's just like sealing the border between Mexico and the U.S.
Let me make
it's a very long border.
No, it's much more difficult. It's much more difficult. The border you have with Mexico is quite easy to seal. Sealing the Greek external border with all the thousands of small islands in the Aegean Sea is impossible. And given the state of affairs of Greece as a whole, and the liability of its, well, the quality of public services, the EU, the non-Schengen borders, EU external borders, have never been tightly closed, let's face it. And Greece was at the center of this problem already 10 years ago. Then there was no massive stream of refugees trying to enter. But the Schengen promise of a rather tight control of the exterior borders of the Schengen area has never worked properly. Schengen seems to be on the at least on a stretcher.
Mm-hmm.
Even Frau Merkel talks about sending back refugees at the German border who had already applied for asylum in Germany before. But just in order to do so, you would have to double check their documents at the border. That means border control re-established, contrary to Schengen. Schengen, so within the Schengen area, there is no border control. And I don't believe that this can be upheld much longer. We will see border controls like the Danes do it, the Swedes do it. You see, this is the difficulty. We have now these individual actions at rather different levels. The Belgians don't control, the French do, the Dutch film everyone entering the country and leaving the country. The Germans do a bit of this and a bit of that, and so on and so forth. This already marks that the idea of the Great Schengen Area is almost a matter of the past.
So I'd just like to sum up a little bit here. What I have not heard is any actual solution that is workable, either in theory or in practice, politically or in reality, to the immigration crisis, which means this is all political talk coming from various capitals and from the EU. Now, I believe Merkel asked for 2 weeks to be able to solve the immigration problem at this summit coming up in Brussels. Our 95% likelihood prediction is that there will be no solution. There will be some words.
Mm-hmm.
So Merkel will come back most likely without a deal that satisfies certainly the Bavarians.
Mm-hmm.
So then what?
That's an open question. I think the Bavarians will go one step further and rephrase the motivation for tight border controls on the German exterior, on the German state line to Austria and the Czech Republic. And I think this will not be named a unilateral action, because if only done by the Seehofer as the Minister of the Interior, Frau Merkel would have been provoked to stop him. And this would might lead to a major crisis of the acting Grand Coalition. And I think nobody involved, neither Frau Merkel nor Seehofer and the Bavarians, nobody within the coalition is ready to stand a new election in autumn. They are as scared as can be. So I don't think they will in the end destroy what they have now and jump on the bandwagon of a new election after such a poor performance during the first 100 days. I don't see this. And as long as the economy is doing well and the German economy is, in spite of all the difficulties we have with the US and others, is still doing quite well, I can't see that they would really risk a new public election. And the result wouldn't be much different. It would be worse for the big parties, and it would be a clear gain, at least in votes and seats for the extreme right.
Okay, let's move on to Latvia. Last week, two bombshells hit Riga. First, the U.S. Treasury accused Latvia's third largest bank of money laundering and evasion of sanctions. Specifically, the U.S. alleges that the bank was processing money for North Koreans. The second bombshell was that the offices of the head of the Latvian Central Bank were raided in a bribery and corruption investigation. Dr. Donner, can you help us understand what's going on in Latvia and why it's important for Europe and the US?
Well, I think it's quite shocking news. It's very rarely talked about in the German press or even in Brussels, because it's such a murky situation. Nobody seems to be clear what's going on. The fact is, Latvia, being a very small economy, rather weak economy, still has quite a big banking sector. And the problem now was brought to public attention by the fact that there was an ECB summit.
The ECB is the European Central Bank.
Indeed, yeah. An ECB summit in Riga. And so all the Draghi's and the national heads of the national banks were assembling there, with the exception of the Latvian guy who's no longer in prison, but he's not allowed to enter his own office building. And his deputy was present, but she has no right to vote. That is the ECB rule. So this was rather embarrassing for the guys assembled, I believe. What exactly happened is still a quagmire. It's very difficult to elucidate. The thing is that there is pretty much a migrating capital in Latvia. Nobody really knows where it's from. Latvia is a Eurozone member state now, and I think that has worsened the situation.
Eurozone meaning they use the EU currency.
They use the EU currency, indeed, and no longer the lat. The lat was a very small local denomination, probably not of much interest to international investors. But now everything is carried out in euros. So the head of the Latvian National Bank has been accused by a whatever Latvian Russian financier that he had asked for more and more money, but the amount quoted in the local press was a ridiculous 100,000 euros, which is $120,000 or less dollars. $120,000 in such a class of money dealing and wheeling is ridiculous amount. So that wasn't very credible. The American investigations have brought about the fact the European Central Bank is very tight-lipped about it. We don't hear anything practically. The thing is it possible that a small economy like a Latvian, and with comparatively large banking sector, is or has been instrumentalized by owners of migrating enormous fortunes
in much the same way that perhaps Cyprus
probably
has done.
Yes, we know from Cyprus the banking issue when the when the banks in Cyprus were closed to the people living there, the Dublin and the Moscow office were open, but you won't find them in the street. They are on the 20th floor of a high-rise building in Moscow. So that was a thing for Cyprus, and you see this in Malta. It's the very same. And Latvia now probably with a strong inclination towards the European continental east. Well, what the Americans accused this bank of was the infringement of sanctions enforced. And of course, I don't know the details about it, but in the end, this bank's probably down and out, and the central bank has the controlling function.
So this is just essentially a big embarrassment for Latvia, but there's no threat, economic threats for Europe
or
wider. It's just that it shows that given the diversity of the countries within the EU, their histories, in Latvia's case, its proximity to Russia, ensuring the same banking standards throughout every member of the Eurozone is practically impossible, and very shrewd people use the various systems to their advantage.
Well, I would really see some kind of strategic approach here. We've talked about this in a previous discussion about Hungarian ties to Russia or China, or Greek ties to China or Russia, where influence is bought alongside with investment, political influence. And that is now indeed a thing we see in various places in the EU, because the individual banking system is highly attractive. Latvia has a strong currency. The euro is a strong currency. Latvia enjoys it. And Latvia is very attractive, Riga in particular, very attractive for foreign investment. Latvia is not economically as feeble as Hungary or as Greece. On the contrary, it's probably not as active as Estonia, but it's quite an active small country. And my understanding is that political scene in Latvia is known very well to outside investors. And given the high quantity of probably Ukrainian or Russian knowledge and investment within the state proper, the idea of using the Latvian euro-based banking system is not very far-fetched. Mm-hmm. It won't shatter the euro, but it shows that there are other areas where you may one day find Panama Papers.
Mm-hmm. Well, it shows, as we were talking about China's growing influence, there are ways of influencing Eurozone and EU countries indirectly, and one way is through the banking system.
I think it's, strategically speaking, this is a far more efficient way than having military maneuvers on the border, because this mostly happens in the twilight of the absence of public knowledge or understanding. I think this is quite clearly the case. New global conflicts may play out less and less where there is visible military presence, but more and more so in the uncharted waters of the internet, the online banking, and the financiers' world.
Yeah. Speaking of the financiers' world, let's move to the third and final topic today, which is Greece. Of course, we've been talking about the bubbling cauldron in the EU, but maybe we have some good news, because this week there seems to be some positive news about the state of the Greek economy as Greece approaches the end of its financial support from the EU, the IMF, and the World Bank on August 20th. Just to refresh our memories, Greece has received 275 billion euros in financial support from international creditors over the past 8 years. Yesterday, on Friday, June 22nd, in Brussels, the Eurozone nations agreed to a plan to end the 8-year bailout. As part of the deal, Greece is able to delay payment on some loans for a further 10 years. And Greece also received 15 billion additional euros.
Mm-hmm.
This to me sounds like a new bailout, but it has not been described this way in the international press. Instead, finance ministers from France and Germany and the European Central Bank seem to be unified in presenting a sunny picture about the sacrifices Greece has made to return to a stable financial situation. Here are some stats that I read on the Greek economy. The Greek economy has grown 1.9% in 2018. Mm-hmm. Unemployment is at 20%, so it's holding steady, improving slightly. The big problem here, though, is youth unemployment, which is still at a staggering 43%. 43% is a lot. Lastly, public sector expenditures have been cut by 26%, which potentially means that some of the corruption in the civil service system has been addressed. So, Dr. Donner, is this Greek deal another bailout, and will it work?
Well, it's the last... It's the dessert of the third bailout and the last installment given to Greece. And now the hope is there, as you've described correctly, that Greece will henceforth be able to refinance herself at the capital markets. The Greek government has, we should just, well, recap a bit the idea. They started as the ultra-left-wing, anti-European, pro-solidarity protest movement, but they have abandoned all this and in the end continue to do what the previous government before them had been doing, namely sluggishly and slowly trying to implement sanctions and conditions imposed on them or bestowed on them by their creditors. The Tsipras government will face elections next year, and this is probably at the center of this all, the whole activity. The European Union, it doesn't look that he'll be re-elected, so I think the polls have it that he'll be defeated massively. Nobody knows who will come after him, because it's very uncertain on making a prediction as to Greek parties today is probably quite a tricky affair. The thing is, will they be able to raise enough money at the capital markets? I have my doubts. Why should one invest in Greek bonds? There is a little an emergency exit. As you know, there is talk about the European Central Bank as a whole stopping the monthly purchase of now 30 billion euros in public and private gilts and bonds.
Is that for every European country, yeah, not just Greece?
But that's just, no, just they have until now not been allowed to buy Greek bonds.
Okay.
The European Parliament has been well in favor of Draghi buying Greek bonds as well, or taking Greek bonds as a security. That we have to use their official language for this, because what they do and what they pretend to be doing is something totally different. This will probably be one way out, that by further reducing the monthly amount of purchase of gilts and treasuries by the European Central Bank, a part might then be directed towards Greece. That would probably help the Greek economy, but I doubt that they will be able to rely exclusively on the market, because that will drive their interest rates quite high, and they won't be able to cope with it. The government as such is probably not much less corrupt than the previous ones, though again one has to face the fact that millions of Greeks have suffered and are suffering enormously. A new trend in Greece is that of having sold everything of value and having consumed their nest eggs, poor people now have to sell their apartment, and buyers from Eastern Europe come and buy them on auctions, and then they throw the people out, and you can buy a Greek apartment for a song and a dance now. That is very brutal. I mean, for the Greek people, the own apartment was something very important. There is a great shortage of properties for rent, so people used to live in their own thing, even if it was in fact owned by the banks. And now these people have no money anymore, and they cannot live within, so it's put to an auction, and that's it. Life in Greece today, for many, not for everyone, for quite a large percentage of the population, is a disaster.
I was quite struck by that number of the high unemployment in Greece, especially for the youth at 43%. It's a sad thing for almost a whole generation. And I noticed also, I can't remember the number, youth unemployment in Italy was quite high. And you can see, I met some Italians the other week, younger Italians, and they were really not positive about the future. And that doesn't bode well for the European Union as a whole. It doesn't bode well for European unity. It doesn't bode well for a more humane refugee and migration policy. It doesn't bode well for the welfare systems. And it is quite a sad thing. And maybe one day we should do a talk or at least a session on youth unemployment and how important it is to change that. But I think we need to end it for today. So thank you again, Dr. Donner.
Thank you very much.
We will be taking a short summer break, but Dr. Donner will be back in a couple of months. If you enjoy The Transatlanticist, please support the show by subscribing for free with iTunes, TuneIn, or your podcast provider. Also, please be so kind as to give us a 5-star rating and review. Your reviews really do help us keep the show going, so please do give us that 5-star rating and review. If you would like to provide comments, suggest topics, or recommend guests, I'd love to hear from you. Please send me an email at asola@americatcentrum.de. That's all, and thanks for listening.